Hey y'all, welcome back to another episode of Put It In Your Pocket, your source for all niche music trivia. My name's Caroline, and today we're going to be taking it pretty easy. I figured it's about time for another records roundtable where I'm just going to be spinning a few songs. I say spinning as if these aren't just downloaded on MP3. I'm going to be playing a few songs that to me fit a specific vibe or niche or genre or whatever. Kind of a filler episode, if you will, if y'all remember the vintage country roundtable that we did a few weeks ago, because we've really been grinding these past few weeks, guys. I feel like we've really been finding our like niche here. We've had like the tail end of Green Day come out. We did the big episode on Hootie and the Blowfish, which was super fun. I did that super long episode on Taylor Swift, and like we've been having a lot of fun, and we've been having some really cool episodes come out. So while I gather my bearings and prepare for the next few episodes, I figured we'd just do this one pretty quick. Guys, I'm so excited for the next few weeks. I have some really fun stuff planned. Just so excited. But this week, we're going to be taking it pretty easy. Probably going to be a pretty short episode. So just strap in and get ready because we're going to the 80s. These are all songs that, to me, the 80s is a very like happy period of music. Like it's all super bright, very like exciting, electronic, modern sounding. Like there was a lot of like really fun stuff happening in this decade. And that's kind of what I've been like looking for recently. And so I revisited some of my favorite 80s tracks, and that's what we're going to be showing today. So the first song, let's just get into it, is Working for the Weekend, released in 1981 by Canadian rock band Loverboy. It was released as the lead single from their second studio album, Get Lucky, and it reached number 29 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100, as well as number 2 on Billboard's Rock Top Tracks chart in February of 1982. It was ranked at number 100 on VH1's 100 Greatest Songs of the 80s, also a lot of other Rolling Stone lists, too many to put. Just a very iconic 80s song. All of these are very classic songs that I feel like everybody will definitely know. Working for the Weekend, they don't play it on the radio a lot, but I feel like it's one of those songs that everybody's just like born knowing. It's just so singable, danceable, and fun. This used to be like my obsessive like get ready for school in the morning song. It's just so hype. I don't know. I just love this song so much. And it has like a really cool story behind it. So it originated when the guitarist of Loverboy, Paul Dean, was walking one Wednesday afternoon looking for inspiration in songwriting. Their first album didn't really do anything. Loverboy's not like a super well-known band either, so he's looking for his first hit. It's the very beginning of the decade, and you can tell this is a very like prime 80s song. It's extremely noticeably 80s. And he was walking out and he noticed that much of the area was like deserted because most people were at work. And so he says, quote, "I'm out on the beach and wondering, where is everybody? Well, I guess they're all waiting for the weekend." So the original title of this song was Waiting for the Weekend, but Mike Reno, the band's vocalist, said that they should change the title to Working for the Weekend, which is strange. I don't really know why he said that, but I think Waiting for the Weekend works just as well. So I just think that's like super funny. Working for the Weekend definitely is like a strange title. And I think that's part of the song's like allure a little bit, is you're kind of like, that's like a little bit like off base a little bit. I've always just loved that. It's a little weird. But according to Paul Dean, he first began writing the song in a hotel room right after they played a Montreal concert. So they were still playing like little bars with not a lot of response from patrons at the time. And after completing the song, they used it to open a set. And Dean recalled that, quote, "the dance floor was packed for the first time in his career," which makes so much sense. Because like I said, this song is super fun and danceable, all of those things. But this song, like I said, is super recognizable. It was used in a Saturday Night Live sketch, Chippendale's Audition, with Chris Farley and Patrick Swayze. It aired on October 27th, 1990, so we're coming up on its anniversary. It also made an appearance in the video game Grand Theft Auto Vice City, which is my favorite GTA game, for all those wondering. And it was used in the launch trailer for Chapter 6 of Fortnite Battle Royale. So there you go. Been used in many, many different things. But like I said, this song's just super fun. When I think about the 80s, I think of songs like this. And I just wanted to start the episode off with something like super exciting like this. So give Working for the Weekend a listen. Hopefully you're familiar with it. But if not, you're definitely in for a treat.
Looking at you. Oh, every
I don't think I'll ever get tired of that song. That song is just so much fun. Oh, I just love that song. But we're going to take a little bit more of a slower turn into Don't Dream It's Over by Crowded House, which is probably on everyone's top songs of the 80s list. I mean, it's just so beloved, just a fan favorite for obvious reason. This song is just beautiful lyrically. It's very beautiful sonically. The vocals are amazing and it is extremely 80s. All of these songs are very noticeably 80s. I think it's just a decade that just very clearly has its own style. I feel like the 70s had a lot of multitudes within it. The 90s definitely had like a weird transition point from beginning to end. And since then, music has been so diverse and has had so many new genres that I feel like there will never be another 80s decade where we have one type of music that is just so out there and so stylistically pointed. And pop in the 80s was it. And Don't Dream It's Over is just, it has all of the things. It's just so beautiful. But let's get into some of the facts about it before we start talking about its lyrics, which are my favorite part. But it's by rock band Crowded House, obviously, and was recorded for their 1986 self-titled debut album. So we're getting a lot further into the decade. And it was composed and written by their frontman Neil Finn and released in October of 1986 as the fourth single from the album. It reached number 2 on the US Billboard Hot 100, and it reached number 1 in Canada, while in Australia it peaked at number 8. In continental Europe, it was number 6, Norway number 27, and number 13 in West Germany. Specifically West Germany, this is 1986. And I don't know, I think all those numbers are so interesting. It's a very European song to me. It's just like very melancholy, and like if this song had a color, it would be like gray to me. I don't really know why that is. And obviously like the accent of their front man, I don't know, it's just very European to me. I think it's funny to look at how things do overseas as opposed to how they do in the US. I think that's so interesting. But at the 1986 Countdown Australian Music Awards, this band is Australian, the song was nominated for 3 awards, winning Best Video, which definitely makes sense. I mean, the music video is gorgeous, but I think it should have won a few more things. I think it's just an amazing song in general. But lyrically, this song is so interesting, and my opinion on it flip-flops pretty much every time I hear it. So at the beginning, when they say, trying to catch the deluge in a paper cup, I've always thought that that was kind of a reference to the Beatles song, Within You, Without You, which could also allude to Across the Universe, where they say, like, words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. This song is very Beatles to me. Not really sonically, but lyrically it's very Beatles. And I think that this would be a super cool reference if that does end up being the reference they're trying to make, because it is a really odd line. And there's a lot of cool ambiguity in the line, don't dream it's over, because is he saying, don't dream because it is over, you know, don't keep hoping, it's done. Or are they saying, we haven't reached the end yet, don't dream that it's over, there's still a chance? I think that you could have both. It could be saying one at the beginning, one at the ending. I don't know. But I think that's, you know, that's what makes a great song, is its ability to kind of cast different shadows on itself as it moves throughout time. And the 80s were a time of great hope, but also great despair, especially towards the end of the decade, especially in other continents such as Europe. I know this isn't a European song, but to me, I don't know, I just antiquate it with the Cold War for some reason. And I don't know, I just think it's so interesting lyrically. So all of those different like opposites and mirrors up to other lyrics and, you know, allusions to other songs make this song just like a standout hit. It's been covered by tons of people, most notably Lauren Daigle. Lauren Daigle has a really good Spotify cover of it. I don't know. I just think it's such a beautiful song. It works in so many different ways. Oh, perfect. It's just perfect. Good pick, Caroline. Good pick. So obviously, everybody has heard the song 100 times, but I'm hoping that you'll find it maybe a little bit more interesting, you know, thinking about the lyrics of it, because it's just so catchy that you really can forget what you're singing sometimes. It's so singable. The last song was danceable. This song's singable. I'm giving lots of really hype songs today, but give Don't Dream It's Over a listen.
Traveling with me. Head now, don't dream it's over.
So this next song that we're going to get into is so interesting, and there's so much to unpack from it that it might take a little minute. So strap in and get ready to go on this journey with me of the story of this song. This song is Rock the Casbah by The Clash, one of the best songs that they've ever written, one of the greatest rock songs of all time. But not a lot of people talk about how cool of a song it is. It's something that you hear and don't really think about a lot. I think we can kind of just write it off as not making sense because there's so many words that we aren't familiar with in it, but it's such a brilliant song. Oh, I could talk about it for hours. I love this song. So let's just get into it. Rock the Casbah was released in 1982 as the second single from their fifth album, Combat Rock. Very fitting title for this song. It reached number 8 on the Billboard Hot 100, which was their only top 10 single in that country. The Clash did a lot better in Europe consistently than they did in the US, which makes sense considering that they are a very European band. And it originated with music written by Joe Strummer and Mick Jones in the songwriting partnership that they had going on. So they just had the recording of the music behind it and no lyrics to go with it. But the other Clash members were really impressed with like that whole creation, saying that they thought that it was pretty much complete and thought about even just releasing it as like a single by itself or just putting it as like an instrumental interlude somehow. But minor overdubs were added, like guitars and percussion, and their management said that it wasn't fully formed enough to put out into the world. Musical interludes were not as popular then as they are now, and they just didn't think it was going to perform very well. Joe Strummer himself was not impressed by the page and what they had done so far, and he said that the suggested lyrics that the band had come up with so far was, quote, a soppy set of lyrics about how much they missed their girlfriends, and said that it was not up to Clash standards. So he took one look at these words, said, how incredibly interesting, screwed the piece of paper into a ball, and chucked it backwards over his head, which is a very Joe Strummer response, and just said, scrap all of this, I'll just do it. And so before hearing the music that had already been written, he had already come up with certain lines like Rock the Casbah, you'll have to let that raga drop, as ideas that he wanted to kind of put in future songs at some point, which is super interesting. you know, as a writer myself, that's something that I do all the time. And to think that, like, one of the greatest rock songs ever was created by piecing together little fragments that already existed is so interesting. I think we kind of have this idea that everybody songwrites like Bob Dylan and just sits down and writes a 7-minute story and just puts it out. But that's often not how great art is made. It can take a lot of time and a lot of painstaking, chucking paper over your head, things like that. And so I think this is a really cool story also because of that. So after hearing the music one more time, Strummer went into the studio's bathroom and wrote the lyrics, finally piecing all of those little fragments together. Some like more inspiration that is super interesting for Rock the Casbah is that Joe Strummer cited Bernie Rhodes, the band's manager, talking about how The Clash was always performing super lengthy songs, especially when they should have been recording studio singles. And he would ask them all the time, does everything have to be as long as the raga, which is a reference to like the Indian musical style that goes on for super long. It's kind of like Indian opera. And that's something that Joe Strummer kind of stuck with and wanted to kind of like pull back to him, and wrote the opening lines to the song, which is, the king told the boogeyman, you have to let that raga drop. So also some really cool like autobiographical stuff going on with this song. But like overall, what this song is talking about is like the ban on Western rock music by a Middle Eastern king. The whole song is fictional, but it does pull inspiration from stuff that was really going on at the time. So there were lots of things going on in the Iranian Revolution in the late 70s where classical music and public concerts were briefly permitted, but the ban overall was on Western, like rock and pop music, and it was reinstated in 2005, coming back even stronger. So public concerts are now still banned, which is crazy. And if you want to be a rock artist in Iran, you have to record in secret under threat of arrest, which is absolutely crazy. And so this song is fictional, talking about fictional events, but it does draw inspiration from real things that were happening at the time and kind of like the culture that was over there at the time and still apparently there, which is wild. How lucky are we to be able to sit and do this podcast, listen to this podcast, listening to this wonderful music? I think it's easy to forget how fortunate we are to be able to love and share the art that we love. Just a little thought that I had there. But the song, after its release, had a very wide legacy. I'm sure that all of you have heard it. But one of the super interesting things about the song is how a lot of people don't hear what they're actually saying, which is very frustrating. This song was chosen by the Armed Forces Radio to be the first song ever broadcast on the service covering the area during Operation Desert Storm, which is, oh boy. Yeah, it just is. We just talked about what the song is about, so I'm sure a lot of you are probably also shaking your heads with me. And in one of the campfire scenes in the late 2007 documentary, it's the documentary Joe Strummer, The Future is Unwritten. I had to look up that title again because I always just say it's the Joe Strummer documentary. But a friend around the campfire is saying that Strummer actually cried when he heard that the phrase Rock the Casbah was written on an American bomb that was going to be detonated in Iraq during the Gulf War, which understandably so. Can you imagine knowing that one of the lyrics of your songs, which is anti-war and anti, you know, fascist and anti-control, has been written on a bomb that you know is going to kill, you know, hundreds of people? And I just think that that's so horrible. And it's a really good lesson in how we don't control the reception of the art we make. This song is not pro-violence. It's not pro-war. It's the opposite. But you can't control what people think of it when it's already out there. And that's like a classic story in music history. It happens all the time. And seemingly to the worst songs possible. American Idiot, they do it with that song. They do it with Holiday. Lots of Bob Dylan songs. Just not a lot of, you know, control once something is put out there into the world. And again, following the terrorist attacks on September 11th, the song was placed on the list of post-9/11 inappropriate titles distributed by Clear Channel, so it was advised against listening to in America. And in 2006, National Review, which is a very conservative news site, released their list of the top 50 conservative rock songs and put Rock the Casbah at number 20, which is so incredibly strange to me. Again, are we listening to this song? I don't understand. I don't understand how you can listen to this song and put it on a list like that. This song is the opposite of conservative. It's a very liberal song. So strange to me. I don't know if people hear what they want to hear. I don't know if we're not actually listening to the words, which is strange if you're making an actual list. I don't know. So strange. It had a very odd life after its release. Very strange. For such a politically charged song, it doesn't make much sense to me. But cultural reviewer and political analyst Charlie Pierce commented that, quote, the notion of The Clash as spokesfolk for the adventurism in the Middle East might have been enough to bring Joe Strummer back from the dead. Which I think is such a funny quote. Absolutely. Joe Strummer would not have been aligned with any of these policies or any of the things that people are doing with this song. And yet that's kind of become this song's legacy. So I don't know. Very, very interesting record just for those reasons alone. Lyrically, super interesting. It's a super fun song. An amazing song. But I think that the legacy that it kind of left behind and continues to evolve with is just so incredibly interesting. I don't know how it's gained the reputation and livelihood that it did, but it did. And like I said, it is interesting to see the life that music takes on after it's put out into the world. You can't control that. You can't change that. Joe Strummer could have said all he wanted, you know, what this song was about and what it meant, but, you know, people are kind of going to hear what they want to hear. And I don't know, it's just a super cool song for all of those reasons. So give Rock the Casbah a listen, and please don't make Joe Strummer turn in his grave any more than he already has. Sadly, we've reached the last song in our catalog today, but it's a good one. It's a good one. My favorite song off this list is the next one that we're going to play. It's called West End Girls by the Pet Shop Boys. I'm hoping that you guys have heard the song 100 times like I have, but if not, I'm so excited for you. It's definitely like the least well-known on this list, but it's still a huge hit. It's so good. It's so good. This song is so haunting. It's so just dark and brooding and interesting, and I just love it. I love it so much. It's definitely not as clean cut as something like Working for the Weekend, but I think that's why it deserves a spot on this list, because I don't know, I think it just rounds it out very well. We've had Rock the Casbah, which is very hard-hitting and very, like, lyrically packed. We have Don't Dream It's Over, that's a lot slower. Things like that. Working for the Weekend, that's just a classic pop hit. And now we have West End Girls, that kind of combines all three of those songs. It's very danceable. It's a good pop song. But we also have some early rap influences that we're going to see, much like the stuff that Blondie kind of started and left for the 90s to finish. Lots of super interesting lyrics as well. Weird stuff going on with the synths. We have a lot of like fading in and out, some city sounds, some water sounds, just some really cool stuff happening here. It's really interesting production. But West End Girls is a song by the English synth pop duo Pet Shop Boys, and it was written by Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe, released twice as a single, which is super interesting. It was released as a dance single early on in the year, and then later it was released on a single off of their next album. In 1987, it won Best Single at the Brit Awards, very British song, very, very British, and the Best International Hit at the Ivor Novello Awards. And in 2005, 20 years after it came out, it was awarded Song of the Decade between 85 and 94 by the British Academy of Composers and Songwriters. A critics poll in 2020 by The Guardian selected West End Girls as the greatest UK number one single of all time, which is crazy. Like I said, it's very British. I'm not going to really explain myself and what I mean by that, but it is so incredibly British. The melancholy of the song, the melancholy of like the synths. Somehow, it's very difficult to make synth sound like dreary, but it does it. Again, this song is very gray to me, like Don't Dream It's Over. Definitely the most close to Don't Dream It's Over out of anything on this list. But it was performed by the Pet Shop Boys at the 2012 Summer Olympics closing ceremony, which is really funny to me. It's kind of a depressing song at like the end of the Olympics, but I thought that was kind of funny. And the story behind this song is also kind of interesting. Tennant started to write it when he was staying at his cousin's house in Nottingham after watching like a gangster film. And just when he was going to sleep, he came up with the lines, "Sometimes you're better off dead. There's a gun in your hand and it's pointing at your head," which is one of my favorite lines of the whole song. It's such a good opener. And the lyrics were actually inspired by T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, specifically in the different use of like narrative voices and arcane references. And the poem itself doesn't have any like direct line allusions, but the poem is a lot about like inner city dealings, the difficulty of living with so many people in one space. It uses a lot of different perspectives, talking about like gender discrepancies, things like that, which are also common themes in the song. So you can definitely see the references there. And Stephen Thomas Erlewine from AllMusic reviewed the album, which is called Please, and he called the song hypnotic, adding that, quote, "It's not only a classic dance single, it's a classic pop single." While those may sound like the same thing, Pet Shop Boys released the single, like I said before, as a dance song, and it became a huge club hit early on in the year, specifically in Europe mostly. And I think that like a dance single is one thing, but a pop single, pop music does not get nearly enough credit. To me, pop music is the pinnacle of all music. It is everything that a marketable song is supposed to be. It's danceable, it's catchy, it's relatable, but when you get a good, hearty pop song, it's lyrically has a lot of depth to it. And West End Girls is the perfect example of that. The lyrics are extremely interesting. It's catchy, it's danceable, it's sing-alongable, it's all of the things. It's radio-friendly, radio-ready, but it also has that depth that you're looking for if you're really a huge music fan. And I think it just does all those things so well. So I agree, it's definitely a classic pop single, one of the best that was put out in this decade by far. Cashbox has a really good quote about it. They called it a sensational pop single and a, quote, "cannily haunting song where disco meets sociology, rap, and the Al Stewart catalog." That is the most wonderful sentence I've ever heard about that song. That is so perfect. Al Stewart, rap, sociology, all of the things. Sociology is a really good way to put it. This song is completely about, you know, the dealings of working in a city and dealing with all sorts of different people, the grittiness of that, the dirtiness of that, and that's why I think it's so British. It definitely feels like something you would hear coming out of like Nottingham or London, but this song just talks about all of those different issues so well, and kind of in like a I don't care attitude way, just like an observational, all-seeing way, not really in a super emotionally impactful way, and I think that's what makes it so on the nose and like interesting to listen to. I think if they were getting like super deep into it, the music would not work as well with it. And what I mean by that is all of those synths that we hear overlaid, all of those different like background vocals would not work with a super, super like brooding, sad, upsetting song with those just like laissez-faire attitudes that both of the singers have. I think that it serves the music a whole lot better. I think it's just a very interesting single. They do a lot of things very well here, and it's a good way to leave off the episode. So give West End Girls a listen, my favorite song off this list, and one of my favorite songs from the 80s.
We'll be right back.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this short little deep dive into some of my favorite 80s songs. Like I said, this was kind of like a little break moment in between all of the, you know, really like longer episodes we've been doing lately, because I have some really fun stuff planned. Next week, we're going to be doing an album review again, and I do expect it to be pretty long. I'm so excited, y'all. I'm so excited for this album and to share it with you guys. Oh, I could not be more excited, but I do anticipate it being pretty long. So strap in. If you're not a fan of the round tables, it's coming, guys. It's coming, I promise. But thank you so much for sticking with me this episode. I really had a lot of fun playing my favorite 80s tunes. It's one of my favorite decades in music. Just, I think that's probably the same for everybody. It's just such a beloved like time period because so much good stuff was happening. So I really had fun this week. Let me know what you think, what you'd like to see next. And as always, my name's Caroline. This has been Put It In Your Pocket. Thank you for listening.